Coming up on Tech Nation, the opioid crisis. In fact, it's three different classes of drugs: prescription opiates, heroin, and fentanyl, synthetically produced heroin. Dr. Nora Volkoff, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, joins me to talk about the grip of addiction. Then on Tech Nation Health, chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft examines misaligned incentives in healthcare. And Dr. Kira Kennedy, CEO of Amplix Pharmaceuticals, tells us about treating life-threatening fungal infections. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 1950, 30% of the U.S. population lived in cities. Today, 80% do. And the world is becoming urbanized. Google anything about the subject, and you see the changes of the last 25 years simply by counting heads in the places they choose to live. Look 25 years before that, and well, life was different. In the United States, looking at its own population growth, there were fears that the entire U.S. would be one big suburb. Freeways everywhere. Everyone would have a car. There were drawings of suburbs throughout the plains and in every mountain meadow. The road from Los Angeles to San Francisco was one long main street. It was a vision left over from the post-war 50s, where suburbs were a new concept, where every family could have a car, and the interstate highway system meant you could pack up that family and travel from coast to coast, border to border. The baby boom had arrived, and by the time they were teenagers, every family had cars, plural. Today, the baby boom's baby boom is having a baby boom of its own. And the first boomers, they're living longer and longer, while the natural swell of population from immigration, a tradition in our country, where, of course, we're all immigrants, well, everyone has to be somewhere, and somewhere turns out to be cities. By 2025, the largest city in the world will keep its long-standing record. It's Tokyo, with 36 million people. The only U.S. city in the top 10 is the New York-Newark metropolitan area with 20 million. But these numbers are difficult to comprehend. Take San Francisco, well known worldwide. The population of the city of San Francisco is a mere 850,000, almost a toy city by comparison. Taking in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's only 7 million people here. So it's time to stop counting people and start looking at what people do and how they want to live. The Bay Area is today snaked by what we generically call Google buses, but really are Google, Cisco, Yahoo, you name it, buses. They drive one way to a workplace in the morning and back at the end of the day, typically with Wi-Fi and specific rules about being quiet, so another hour or two of work or rest or entertainment is guaranteed. Even the short jaunt from South San Francisco and its great bio cluster has its own runs, featuring Genentech's Genenbus, the DNA Shuttle, and others to get you where you want to go, even mass transit. Get off your bus and take an Uber or Lyft the very last mile. The presumption of owning a car has disappeared among these folks, and for good reason. A car doesn't mean status or freedom. It means expense and problems like parking. While you can rent a car for a day or an hour, but it's not without its problems. I was shocked recently when I brought up one of the Lyft or Uber apps to find the notice, "No cars available." What? I tried again, and then again. The other service came right through. Later that day, I hailed one again, and I looked down to see that the car driving up the university's driveway right then was to meet me. He waved as he drove past, dropped his passenger 50 feet beyond, and circled back. 15 seconds between rides? Only with technology. Urbanization looked good. They used to say, people vote with their feet. I'd bet today, people vote with their smartphones. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, the opioid crisis, from prescription opiates to heroin to fentanyl. Dr. Nora Volkoff, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, explains the grip of addiction. Then on Tech Nation Health, chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft addresses the idea of misaligned incentives in the healthcare field. And Dr. Kira Kennedy, the CEO of Amplix Pharmaceuticals, tells us about their work with severe, life-threatening fungal infections. We keep hearing about the opioid crisis, or the opiate crisis. Dr. Nora Volkoff is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, one of 27 institutes at NIH. I asked her to characterize the opioid crisis from her perspective.
The opioid crisis tends to refer to the very significant increases that we are seeing throughout the country on people dying from opiates. And initially, this crisis was initiated by the abuse and diversion of opioid medications that are given by physicians to treat their patients for pain. And they were being overprescribed. And as a result of that, that resulted in diversion. These medications can be quite addictive. And when taken at higher concentrations, are very dangerous because they can result in sleep and in respiratory depression, which is the cause of death. And as people started to become addicted to their pain medications, what happened was they found that it was easier and cheaper to use heroin. And so we observe, 7 years ago in the United States, a really steep increase in the abuse of heroin, which in our country had been stable for many, many years. And then all of a sudden, the different states started to report, doubling, tripling in deaths from overdoses from heroin. So we went from very, very high numbers of people dying from prescription of opioids to then adding into those numbers people dying from heroin. And more recently, I would say perhaps in the 5 years since 2010, 7 years, again, we're seeing another curve that is increasing further the number of people dying from opioids due to the emergence of synthetic opioids that are very, very, very potent, like fentanyl. And what has happened is that fentanyl is a synthetic chemist produced from scratch, as opposed to having to create a plant where which you extract the poppy seeds and then you actually extract morphine and then you have heroin. It is estimated to be 50 times more potent than heroin, and so you require a much smaller concentration. So from the supply perspective, it's very easy to bring it up across the borders. And this fentanyl is believed to be produced in China. It goes through Mexico, and it has hit particularly badly the northern eastern part of the United States. So in places like New Hampshire, in places like Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Maine, we've seen tripling or quadrupling of the number of fatalities over the past 5 years from the introduction of these synthetic opioids. So when we're speaking about the crisis, we're speaking about three different classes of drugs that are responsible for it. Initially, prescription opioids, which continue to account for a very significant number of people dying from them. Then we have heroin, which is now very cheap and high purity and very easy to access. And now fentanyl. And coroner reporters are actually finding is that many of the cases in the Northern East associated with fatalities in Massachusetts, 2/3 of them were linked with fentanyl. So this is with the whole process of the crisis. And it's focused on overdoses. But the reality is that there are many other layers to this crisis. For example, there's been a really dramatic increase in cases of neonatal abstinence syndrome. And these are babies that are born of women that were consuming opiates during their pregnancy. And when they are born, they are physically dependent to the opiates, so they are going through withdrawal. And that withdrawal can be very severe. It can lead to seizures. In some instances, one of the treatment interventions for these babies is to give them morphine to slowly detoxify them. And many of them have to go into neonatal intensive care units, which actually are extremely costly. So this is an aspect of it that states have started to speak about it because of here you have the most vulnerable of all, newborn children being exposed while they are in the mother's womb to opiate medication and becoming dependent to it. Another crisis has been the hepatitis C infection, which has risen significantly over the past few years because of the injection of contaminated needles. And that is driven, again, by the opioid epidemic that we are observing. Another aspect that hasn't neither attracted so much attention is endocarditis. So patients that are injecting are actually at high risk on developing these infections into their hearts and end up in the hospital with very expensive procedures. So we're seeing all of these downstream consequences of what the opioid crisis is doing to our country. And it's affecting everyone. It's in the past, you're thinking about, when we think about drug use and who is affected, we always think about young people in their 20s or those that comes from very deprived environments with very high levels of stressors that puts them at higher risk of taking drugs. In this epidemic, we're seeing it affecting everybody. And in fact, you know, at one point, the demographics where we were seeing the highest rates of fatalities, the increases in fatalities, not in total absolute, but the increased rates were going faster, was for women between 45 and 54 years of age, which is not your demographic. Yes, exactly. That's what I said. What? Because, and that was very important, certainly, to me and to my brain, because many dismiss the prescription opioid epidemic by saying, oh, this is just people diverting the medications in order to get high, because they make you feel good. And it is correct that there is a significant part of the problem initiated by people that pursue these medications in order to get high. But the fact that we were having 45 to 54-year-old women dying from prescription opioids, which is not the demographic at higher risk of abusing drugs, brings up the question, which is to what percentage of those cases were driven by patients who were prescribed these opioid medications and who may have, for whatever reason, were vulnerable, become addicted to them. They didn't seek them out. They became addicted because a doctor prescribed them. And other patients where they are being prescribed these medications don't necessarily become addicted to them, but then overdose. So the issue made it clear that this epidemic is more complex than others that we've seen in the past that are driven from the inception to seek a drug in order to get high.
And in many senses, we're seeing the fringe measurements, the people who have overdosed or the people who have died or the infants who are born with the addiction. We go around and around and around. This represents the outline. We haven't talked about the people who are living chronically with this for many years, their families, their children, all of the effects that are undeniable.
Yes, and we've been discussing this and actually trying to bring forward the importance of recognizing addiction as a chronic disease of the brain, as opposed to the stigmatized perception that this is moral
behavior. Just say
favor.
No.
Yeah, yeah, no, the notion of the person does not have the strong will, that determination to stop taking the drug as if it were a choice. And I basically brought up this issue for many, many years. No one chooses to become addicted. A lot of kids experiment with drugs, and we've all experimented with drugs. Alcohol is a drug, and yet only a few develop addiction. Just like you can smoke cigarettes, not everybody is going to develop lung cancer. Certainly, if you smoke regularly, your risks are higher. The same thing with drugs. But the issue of what is the transition from drug experimentation into addiction? What happens in the brain that leads to that loss of control? And why does it happen in some people and not in others? Are very important questions because they actually are relevant for two things. One of them, how to treat addiction, and the other one is how to prevent it.
When we're talking about the science of addiction, does it matter what substance you're addicted to?
All of the drugs have a common pharmacological action, and that is that they activate the dopamine reward systems in the brain. How they do it varies from one drug to the other. And so some of them, for example, activate this system directly by releasing dopamine or by actually allowing dopamine to accumulate because they actually inhibit the recycling. So it just accumulates and accumulates, like cocaine, methamphetamine are those class of drugs that go directly to the dopamine system. Others do it indirectly, like the opiates. The opiates, what they do is they basically inhibit the inhibitory neurons that are stopping dopamine. So there is an inhibitory neuron that is putting the brakes in dopamine. So they take the brake off.
And
exactly.
Then, that's the thing. Dopamine comes rushing out.
That they release. So that's the common one. And that is fundamental because that's ultimately what triggers the changes that lead to the loss of control in addiction. But on top of that, each drug has its own characteristics. And for example, in the case of opiates activate. Their effects are mediated by activating receptors that are our brain and body use to modulate processes such as regulating pain, such as regulating the experience of pleasure. Those are mediated by mu opioid receptors. So you produce your own endogenous opioids. You liberate them when you are actually something, for example, physical contact with someone you are in love with. Liberates endogenous opioids, and that's extraordinarily pleasant. And it's very important, that signaling system, to create bonding and relationships, where heroin, morphine, Vicodin also activate those receptors, and that's why they can be very pleasurable. But these receptors are also located in the areas of the brain that are responsible for modulating our perception of pain. And so they inhibit the experience, the sensation of these pain signals. And that's why they are so potent as analgesics.
What about alcohol? How does that operate?
Oh, alcohol is a dirty drug. It's a dirty drug because it goes after multiple targets. And, you know, so you speak about cocaine, methamphetamine, they do very much. I mean, they have some little extra things, but they predominantly do dopamine. And opioids do the opioid receptor system. Alcohol does not discriminate, and it goes to actually the cells that inhibit, the breakers of the dopamine cells. It actually disinhibits them too. But it also inhibits stimulatory systems. And what happens is alcohol is believed to actually act by modifying the fluidity of membranes in neurons, and that modifies the functionality of the receptor. And that's why it affects so many receptors, because by modifying its configuration, it can actually enhance or depress the signaling of that receptor system.
This is such a fascinating and complex area. We've been talking about addiction and the reason that it's so wonderful to take all these drugs. in short term.
No, it is. Our brain is hardwired for pleasure. It's not. We shouldn't feel guilty about it. It's the way that nature ensures that we will do behaviors that are fundamental for our survival. If we didn't feel pleasure by eating, we wouldn't survive. I mean, who would go through the efforts? Now we have all of this food, easy access to food, but this is recent. In the past, we would have to risk our lives in order to get food. And so if it was not a strong motivator, so what pleasure does, it creates a memory that will motivate your behavior. And it's not that you are consciously aware about this motivating behavior. So like the infant, when it's born, it actually is hungry and it doesn't know how to. It's going to actually be able to remove that sensation. It doesn't know that they are hungry. And then by the mother holding it, it finds out that the milk is extraordinarily pleasurable. It's the sweetness. And that immediately generates a memory that would allow that infant to learn on one exposure that actually stimuli will relieve that sensation of distress and becomes rewarding. And that motivates the behavior. And that's what's so powerful about drugs. They directly strengthen the motivational system. They hijack that system brought by millions of years of evolution to motivate behaviors. They hijack it to make it to motivate you to seek the drug.
When we talk about overcoming addiction, do we know that you have to have total abstinence, or is there a possibility that you could restore some control? Is relief from addiction absolutely have to be abstinence from a scientific point of view?
Well, you know, in science, you come to realize that there are very few things that you can say with 100%, this is the way to go. Clinically, definitively, we do recommend patients to stay away from drugs. If they are addicted, the exposure to drugs will trigger very likely a relapse. And you can do this in animal models where you can take a rat or a mouse or a non-human primate, make them addicted to the drug. Then you remove them for 6 months and you give them a tiny, tiny little dose of the drug and they immediately escalate to compulsive drug taking with a tiny little drug and dose. And the issue is in addiction, what you are generating is you are strengthening that memory that favors certain patterns of behaviors that are going to take precedence over others. So it creates a memory that is very difficult to erase. And again, this is very relevant because in the past, and people still believe that you just need to put someone that has been taking drugs, remove them and put them for abstinence for 6 months, for 2 years, and then they are cured. And that is not the case. The moment that you bring them back into the environment where they've taken that drug in the past or they get exposed to a stressful situation, they will relapse because the memory will be activated. And so part of the treatment is, what is it that you can do to weaken that memory? Well, at the same time, to superimpose other memories that can take over, to create a balancing. So that's part of the treatment interventions. But coming to your question of the issue of abstinence, so that's where I'm coming, because those memories are long-lasting and that changes. And researchers now, for example, have investigated at the level of the synapse, which is where the two neurons communicate with one another in these reward centers, what are actually the proteins, what are happening to the proteins that are expressed in these areas where they communicate that are accounting for these priority of signaling in this pathway. So we know a lot about it, which is also important because then we can try to revert it. But with respect to the notion of abstinence, we know that these changes are very long-lasting and that the structural changes in the brain are very long-lasting and they persist years after the person has stopped taking the drugs. And that's why our message is that you should try to avoid taking the drug if you don't want to relapse. There are definitively cases, again, that's why I don't like to say 100%. There are individuals that, for example, and this has been documented, boy for addiction to nicotine. It has also been documented for addiction to alcohol, who had had a very serious problem with addiction to these substances and then can later on, several years later, smoke here and there or drink here and there. But it's more the exception, and it's too high of a risk. And that's why, even though I concede that it is possible, I think it's not worth the risk.
So the next question is, given that we know that these very strong memories, you've laid down paths in your brain, very strong paths in your brain with great reward systems or believed rewards, where does this leave the next steps to attempt treatment other than to bring people to abstinence?
Well, what we are doing is actually, of course, what we do in medicine is actually do science so that we have treatments that can facilitate for patients to achieve better outcomes and to recover. So what we want them is not just to become abstinent, but be able to function in a productive and fulfillful life. And so it's not you just actually have someone and you remove them and they are abstinent. You remove them in sort of a secluded place. You want them to contribute to society, to be part of a family, and
have other positive things that they are sober enough to know that I don't want to lose these.
And that they can give to others. I mean, each person has the unique capacity of give something that no one else can do. So how do we bring these people back into all of us? So and there are many strategies that we are employing, and that again is based on our understanding that goes from, can we develop medications that can help a person control these very strong urges that once they hit you, I actually put up, because if you haven't been addicted, it's very hard to actually, I think, imagine what would it be to not be able to control things. So where you say, I'm not going to take that drug. I'm not going to take that drug because tomorrow they are going to be testing my urine, and if it's positive, I'm going back into prison. So I'm not going to do it. And yet the possibility of such an outcome does not deter the patient. Or where they know, for example, right now with all of the fentanyl overdoses that we actually are hearing all over the media, where some the individuals that are addicted to these drugs are so addicted that they seek out the dealers that sold the drug to the person that overdosed because they know it's going to be a very potent drug. So this defies our reasoning mechanisms that are actually constructed to safeguard us, to prevent us from going into harm. So under what conditions our brain can actually go into that mode of operation that we forgo our own survival? And that's when, if you don't do something, you'll die faster.
I'm speaking with Dr. Nora Volkoff, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of TechNation, BioTechNation, and TechNation Health are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on TechNation Health, misaligned incentives in healthcare and the challenge of treating severe life-threatening fungal infections. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Dr. Nora Volkoff, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
So under what conditions our brain can actually go into that mode of operation that we forgo our own survival? And that's when, if you don't do something, you'll die faster. So if you are food deprived, if you haven't eaten for 1 or 2 weeks, your brain is going to go into a completely different set of operations where your behavior will lead you to do things that are going to be very risky in order to get the food right now, because otherwise you're not going to survive. And drugs seems to bring the brain into belief that if they don't get the drugs right now, they will not survive. So you've modified the flexibility of the brain to accommodate its operations as a function of urgency of need. So it's not that initially, yes, the drugs are making you feel good and high, and that's the way that actually you get hooked. It's like the seductive component of the drug, which is brought up by dopamine. And that's the way nature intended it. Nature intended it to, the first time you engage on something that's new and novel, is extraordinary, rewarding, dopamine is liberated, and that generates the memory. But once that memory generated, you are driven by the motivation, you are driven by the memory, whether it is pleasurable or not, that drives you. And so drugs are these extremely potent chemicals that are activating that system. So they drive this hyper-motivation. And that's why you end up in people that are vulnerable for the rapid changes. Because, I mean, so when you create this hyper-motivation, how fast does it develop? Why is it that some people can control it or not? And that relates to the fact that each one of us is different. And so some people have vulnerabilities because those memories form faster. Or they may have vulnerabilities because when they were being brought up, they were experiencing extraordinary stressful environments. So they are already at a disadvantage because of the negative effects of those developmental experiences on their brain that makes them more vulnerable to taking drugs. And so when you have these issues colliding with one another, you have someone that takes a drug for whatever situation it is, that then go into escalation and becomes addicted and in the process loses the capacity for self-control.
Dr. Volka, I have to say this has been extraordinary in the sense that you aren't just stating statistics, you aren't just stating science, you're giving us some real insight into being human and what this means for being human. So thank you so much. And I hope you come back, see us again. You're always welcome.
You're very welcome, and thanks a lot.
Dr. Nora Volkoff is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. Today, our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, addresses the idea of misaligned incentives in healthcare. While everyone is trying to do the right thing, their individual incentives may not match up. Then Dr. Kira Kennedy, the CEO of Amplix Pharmaceuticals, tells us about the challenge of treating severe, life-threatening fungal infections. There are many actors in healthcare: doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, federal healthcare programs, and the list goes on. Their incentives to perform are not always in alignment. Dr. Daniel Kraft is our chief correspondent.
Healthcare is super complex. There's no one healthcare system, certainly not in the United States. And it's really much more of a sick care system. We reward treating disease once it's already happened. The data that we get is very intermittent and reactive, whether it's your blood pressure, blood sugar, or keeping you healthy. So we wait for the heart attack, the stroke, or the cancer to be discovered at late stage. That's sort of the way the models are worked. That's how folks are rewarded. The hospital CEO wants the beds full. The primary care doctor might them empty. The pharma CEO wants the drug prices ratcheted up. The insurance companies want to play as little as possible. So, and we have to ride the line of, you know, how do we pay for smart elements of healthcare. Number one, hopefully moving the needle towards more prevention and optimizing health, picking up disease early rather than late. And then when we have therapies, to make sure that they really work, because a lot of our healthcare system is rewarding not precision medicine, but imprecision medicine. We're prescribing a large number of drugs, as was published a few years ago in Nature, that only work for a fraction of the folks we prescribe them to. So I think as we hopefully shift, whatever happens to Obamacare or Trump care, or I like to joke, Putin care, you know, at least in Russia, they all get some coverage. We are going to need to think about, as we do changes, how do we align the incentives across these different players, whether it's a large payer like Medicare or the VA or a Kaiser, all the way down to our individual selves and how we use our own motives and motivations to stay proactive and keep ourselves healthier for longer.
Well, as a person in any healthcare system, and as, of course, the most important one is you, how do you know you're really in a web of misaligned incentives?
Well, we often see it, you know, even just trying to get a, let's say, a specialty consultation for, let's say, a funny skin lesion you might have. Well, you might have to jump through the hoop of seeing your primary care doctor, who can then approve your consultation visit. You finally get that 2 months later. They look at you for 2 minutes and write your prescription or send you home. We're seeing that being disrupted by smart digital health folks, which are doing, for example, skin scan type apps, which can look at that lesion, send it to a dermatologist, or in the future, it may be machine learning or AI that does it. We're seeing misaligned incentives in terms of you're in a hospital. You may need this particular drug or device might be best for you, but you may have to get permission from your insurance company. Lots of paperwork, lots of costs there to let them argue, no, you deserve the run-of-the-mill version. So we can kind of see it in sort of the daily practice of medical care, particularly when we get on more complex cases. We can see it in the era of the fact that our healthcare systems may not pay for you to have a smart set of crutches at home. You may have a risk of fall and back in the hospital with $1 million at readmission. Sometimes simple things could be paid for, whether it's a digital blood pressure cuff to manage hypertension that could prevent you from having a stroke or a heart attack, that aren't covered today. Sometimes because we don't often have the data, the clinical trials, which today often take $1 billion per drug in 10 years, we need to reimagine those. We're seeing the ability to do clinical trials on your smartphone, to have folks who are like real people, not the very narrow subset that can qualify for a clinical trial, demonstrate what could be useful for prevention, diagnostics, or therapy. So as we start to hopefully align the incentives, we can align the data and allow each of us to contribute, to be participatory in healthcare. The new drug might be you, the CEO or the CO of your own health, to share the data from your wearable devices into your medical record, to share the risk, to hopefully pay for that yoga class or the smoking cessation or that digital scale that'll help you lose weight and keep you from becoming a diabetic in 5 years. So lots of small examples and nudges. The challenge is, given we have a very fragmented healthcare system, to get folks to recognize the value of proactive care or smarter personalized medicine when the data supports it.
Well, it certainly changes the perspective from me and them, they decided, or he decided, or she decided. This is not like something's wrong with them. This is actually, we're talking about misaligned incentives.
Well, if we can realize that it's no longer be Dr. Welby, you go to the doctor and they're the paternalistic one who tells you what to do, and you, quote unquote, own your own health, the idea of, quote unquote, patients included, or the fact that you have your own data, you should own your own data, whether it's your genomic information or from your medical device or from your wearables, and align the incentives on using that, maybe even being rewarded for sharing that. If we could build those Google Maps for health by sharing our data, our omics, we can align some of those incentives and realize that we ideally should be the co-pilots of our care. And align the incentives to pay for proactive prevention, reward folks who get early screening when it's indicated, reward those folks developing, whether it's an app, a device, a digiceutical, other therapeutics that are not just better care at lower price, but get folks engaged, including making that what's often called the triple aim, you know, better care, lower price, more effective. The quadruple aim is also recognizing that some of these new technologies and incentives should help the poor, overwhelmed clinician, the nurse, the pharmacist. They're often being burnt out with our era of technologies and more checkboxes. In fact, physicians today in the United States, as was recently published, spend twice as much time having to type in their medical record notes, which are really for billing, right, a misaligned incentive, then yeah. FaceTime looking at their patient, holding their hand, using hopefully new smart tools, whether it's a connected app or a FaceTime or a wearable to help them stay on track with prevention or managing a disease. So I'm hopeful we can start to, first of all, have the optics of where the incentives lie and use the the power of understanding that to shift healthcare in smarter ways and move the puck to where it should be.
Well, you are a physician. I asked you in terms of, well, what about the patient? How do they know? As a physician, does it impact you?
Well, it's all again about incentives. You know, the surgeons get paid to cut. They're going to want to cut. We can see that when the incentives are misaligned, for example, to do more procedures, more CT scans, more biopsies, more stents, even when sometimes the best medical evidence doesn't support it, but the insurance company does. Because today it's not really – I'm stealing this term from my friend Dr. Dean Ornish. We don't practice evidence-based medicine. We practice reimbursement-based medicine. Today it's mostly fee-for-service. I, as a physician, or most healthcare systems, you'll get paid to do more procedures, more biopsies, more admissions. We're moving to this new era. It's often called value-based care, where the hospital system is going to get paid to keep you healthy. Hopefully the physician may get a bonus at the end of the year if their panel of patients on average has lower blood pressures or better blood sugar controls. So yes, as a clinician, if you can get those incentives aligned, if I can get paid for doing a telemedicine consult or prescribing you a wearable after your total hip replacement or after your surgery to help watch you get moving, if I, as Dr. Kraft, can see Moira's data, which is starting to happen, and I can give you digital nudges or see when you're getting in trouble and not wait for you to show up in the emergency room, we'll align those incentives to use some of these new connected digital tools or more personalized genomics or other fancy therapies to give us value-based care. And we may, as we're starting to see, only start paying for drugs, devices, applications, all the way to gene therapies when they work, not just for prescribing them.
I go back to the pediatricians we had when my boys were very, very small. And if you went in and they took a swab and they prescribed some antibiotics, you easily could get a call every day, oh, throw that away, we got more. And it turned out that the very senior fellow in the practice came in like 6:30 every morning and just looked at slides before anything happened. And he just said, what was yesterday? What's today? What do we have here? And we didn't pay for that. The insurance company didn't reimburse for that. But we got such good care, no broad spectrum, you know, prescriptions. And so there's an example of great care, but it's outside the reward system, the economic reward system.
And most of us go into healthcare not to be pressing buttons and getting billing forms done. We want to be taking great care of patients. And we have a lot of new tools to eventually do that. I'm training as a pediatrician. Back to the child example, a lot of parents have kids with ear infections. We might prescribe them an antibiotic or want to wait, but we often say, hey, come back with little Johnny in 3 days. We'll look in their ear again. Well, there are now ways to put a little attachment on your smartphone, one called CellScope, where I could send you home with an attachment on your smartphone and we can look in your ear through the camera, and you could send me the video or the picture, and I might use that to manage the child's otitis media, ear infection. But is anyone going to pay for that little attachment? Is anyone going to reward the company that builds that app? Who's liable for the data? That's where we need to start aligning incentives. If the pediatrician doesn't feel that they can get reimbursed or rewarded for doing that e-consult, that kind of technology is one small example may not work. So we need to use some of these new tools, new technologies, align the incentives, and bring us back to what many of us in healthcare started with, where we want to really help people and use all the tools at our disposal to do that and not be at the behest of, let's say, the insurance companies who often have the hammer on what we can and can't do.
So as tech marches on, as science marches on, we have to really take a look at that and keep adjusting incentives.
And again, they're different for different folks. The biggest incentive we can all hopefully provide in shifting the needle is to give us individual incentives to stay on top of our health, to be that COO of our health in partnership with our healthcare team, to hopefully own your omics and other data and use that to optimize your diet. Maybe you need to tune your microbiome, go to the gym. Maybe your insurance company will be inspired to reward you for doing those 10 or 15,000 steps a day. We're starting to see that happen. It's a bit big brotherish. There's a bit of a slippery slope. But when we can start to measure certain behaviors, our bad sleep, diet, stress, alcohol, drug use contribute to most of our chronic diseases and most of our chronic costs, trillions of dollars a year. So shifting behaviors in minor ways can really extend our health span and lower costs and improve life for all of us.
And I have to say, you know, the 10,000 steps, 15,000 steps, you know, that's pretty general. I think individually, I think I'm like a 415-step person.
415?
Yeah.
Well, 10,000
steps. So I do really well when I...
415 is not enough. 10,000 steps is not a magic number, but we know that 30 minutes of exercise a day, a brisk walk, is probably the best drug for prevention, whether it's for obesity, for depression, for cancer risk. We don't need fancy high-tech tools. We can all sort of hopefully use some of these new elements to match our carrots and sticks and get ourselves moving and hopefully not need some of the more complex diagnostics and therapies that we have in our armamentarium today.
Well, you won me over, Daniel.
See you on the racetrack.
There you go. Thanks. Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent for TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. Fungus and mold, which is a type of fungus, exist everywhere, even inside the healthy human body. There they are kept in check by our immune systems. When patients become very ill, they are susceptible to all kinds of infections, and this includes severe, life-threatening fungal infections. Dr. Kira Kennedy is the CEO of Amplix Pharmaceuticals.
You know, these are the infections that kill a lot of patients who are struggling to deal with a disease like leukemia or lymphoma. So when you get that diagnosis, you know you have chemotherapy ahead of you. You may have a bone marrow transplant to try and repopulate your blood cells. And what I think what people don't realize is that these treatments compromise the immune system, and that can make people much more vulnerable to these types of infections. And that includes bacterial infections, but also fungal infections. And fungal infections can kill a patient in a matter of weeks if they're not appropriately managed.
Now, let me ask you, you're already under treatment for whatever condition, severe condition you're under.
That's right.
Do sometimes those treatments actually aid the growth of the fungus?
So what they do is they kill the neutrophils in your body, the white blood cells that would normally take care of this. So everybody on the planet is exposed to fungal cells that if your own immune system can't take care of those and clear those out of your body, can become a disease for you. So what happens, these treatments, the chemotherapy, the radiation therapies, they destroy that part of the immune system and the fungus can grow unchecked.
So you may already have this fungus.
Yes.
And you didn't catch it.
Right. Oftentimes, that's what happens. The fungus is, you know, in your lungs, you're breathing it in, you know, candida or yeast is in your GI tract. If you have surgery and your GI tract is compromised, then the fungus gets into in a place where it's not supposed to be, and it's unchecked, and it can grow and cause a fatal infection.
How hard is it to target a fungus with a treatment?
So this is a really interesting point, and this comes down to biology. So genetically, fungi and human, from a DNA perspective, were not all that different. So we oftentimes, a drug that is toxic to a fungus can be toxic to a patient. So what you want to make sure you're doing is not making the patient worse. And there are drugs that have been approved for a long time now that are toxic to the kidneys, or drugs that are toxic to the liver or cause hallucinations. And all of these side effects of drugs.
You already have a terrible disease. Then you have you've got a fungal infection.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take a treatment for that.
For that.
That causes these issues.
Right.
This is not good.
No, this is not good. These are really sick patients. And what these patients need is a safer option that can address that infection without making them worse by the side effects that come with some of these drugs that are available today.
So Amplix has a treatment that you're ready for phase two. You're about to start that. We'll talk about that in a second.
That's right.
Why is it different? What does it do and why is it different?
What does it do? So our treatment is a new target. So it's a new aspect of how a fungal cell works, that once we stop it, the cell can't function properly. The wall of the fungal cell can't form, and that's really important in how that goes on to form an infection. So what we do is we basically shut that cell down, and then the infection can't take hold and can't progress. So this is our product that's been in the clinic now. We know it's safe in humans. It's the first time this target has ever been tested in human clinical trials. So we're really excited to offer this as an option for patients who struggle with these infections and their physicians who really struggle to try and manage them.
Are you looking at big side effects as well?
You know, we are not. The profile of this drug is really, really what we call in the industry, it's really clean. So we don't see any changes to how the liver is working. We don't see any changes to how the kidneys are working. You know, we see very, very mild nausea or headaches. But when you're faced with a life-threatening infection, that's something I think anybody would be willing to tolerate with the hope of beating that infection and then getting to go on with their lives.
Have you any idea why that's so?
The target, the protein that we're targeting in fungus, doesn't exist in humans. And that's why we have such a safe drug. So we don't attack any human cells because they don't produce this protein. So, you know, there really is nothing for this drug to interact with in a specific way in the human body.
So what will your phase two look like? What do you do? How do you test it?
So we are starting up phase twos in different types of infections. And you really categorize these patients by what's their infection. So patients who have an invasive yeast infection, which is a body-wide yeast cells circulating in the blood, impacting how organs are treated. Those are the patients that we're going to enroll in our first invasive candidiasis study. And these are patients that have had a trauma or a surgery or they're in the intensive care. Sometimes these infections start in the catheter site. So the patients have a catheter or they have a port for the administration of other medications, and that can become the site of infection. You can't take away the port because you need to still deliver the drugs, so you really need to manage that infection. And then the other study we're going to do is a study in invasive mold infections, so aspergillosis. Lots of really Ooh. Weird words, aspergillosis, scedosporiosis, mucormycosis. These are the really scary infections. These are the infections that have mortality rates where 70% of the patients will die. Or even higher, depending on the particulars of that patient. So these are patients that are immune compromised. They may be a leukemia patient who's had a bone marrow transplant, and they are in the ICU. They're not doing very well. They have a fungal infection that's uncontrolled, and those are the patients that we will treat.
So you're having to go around saying, "Who's got a big problem?"
Maybe
exactly.
Right. And this is one of the differences between this type of research and, for example, rheumatoid arthritis research, where you can identify your patients beforehand. You know they have the condition. Maybe you know they meet the criteria for the study. Here, we have to be ready and waiting for that patient to show up in the hospital. And so we work with centers that know that they get X number of cases per year, and they treat a lot of oncology patients, or they do a lot of transplants and organ transplants. So they know that this is something that they have to deal with, and they know if they have experience with resistance or resistant organisms. So we hear a lot about bacterial resistance. Resistance is also an issue in the fungal world. So, you know, bugs are smart. They will. Every drug that we come up with, they will find a way around it. So we need new options, and there's only been one new class of antifungals approved in the last 30 plus years. So we really need some new options to address the resistance that's emerging in these infections.
What strikes me is that even when you find the good candidate that needs it, they're ready for it, every single one of these subjects have a different underlying condition, have a different course of treatments, mm-hmm. things in there. I mean, we have no uniform population to study here.
We don't, but it's uniform infection. So it's either a Candida albicans or a Candida auris now, which is a really scary fungal infection, or an Aspergillus fumigatus. So you're killing the bug, and you're treating the fungal infection almost irrespective of what that patient looks like from an underlying disease or an underlying medications that they're taking. So you're really attacking the fungus. And that's the common theme through all these patients.
How do you know the level of infection they have, for starters, mm-hmm. and how do you know that there's been a reduction in the fungal infection?
That's a great question. And the answer, and part of what's tied into this, is how do you diagnose that patient with that infection and how do you know exactly what you're treating? And in some cases, you don't. You don't know exactly what you're treating. And it depends on the different types of fungal infections. So if you have a candida infection or yeast infection, that kind of looks like a bacterial infection. You can draw blood cultures. You can figure out exactly what the infection is. And then when the blood no longer has yeast in it, you know that the infection is cleared. You probably still want to treat that patient to make sure that that infection doesn't reoccur for a period, but you have a clear black and white readout of how the drug is working. It's a little more challenging in the mold infections. Here, the diagnostic tools are really not as advanced or as sophisticated, and part of it's got to do with how the mold grows. So if you think of, you know, you've been on vacation, you forgot to throw out your loaf of bread.
I was going to say, would you like to visit my refrigerator? You could probably start three companies on what you could find there.
But yeah, so the mold grows in a lump, and that's how they grow in your lungs, and they start to invade out of your lungs through the walls of the lung. They don't necessarily rely on the bloodstream to get around. So it's harder to define a diagnosis of a specific mold infection. And it's also harder to, you know, make sure that that infection is gone. But what you can do is there are what are called clinical symptoms. So if you have a CT scan of the lung and you see there's a shadow, right. And some of them look pretty particular. There's a halo sort of symbol or, you know, around the infection. So you look at, is that getting smaller? Well, first of all, you look, has the patient still living? I mean, that's readout number one. I mean, these are pretty black and white in terms of what's going to happen for that patient. But, you know, you see how they're doing clinically. Are they improving? Is their fever subsiding? And then you look at the x-rays and the CT scans of the lungs to see, is that ball of fungus getting smaller? And in some ways, you're attacking the fungus directly, but you're also buying time for that patient, for their own immune system to recover so that it can take over the job of making sure that that fungus is kept at bay.
Well, Kira, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I hope you come back. Keep us updated.
Thank you. I would love to.
Dr. Kira Kennedy is the CEO of Amplix Pharmaceuticals. More information is available at amplix.com. That's A-M-P-L-Y-X, amplix.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.